Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It's good to see a lot of familiar faces. As you said, I'm going to talk about a new production mechanism for axions today in pulsar magnetosphere gaps. This is based on some recent work as well as a lot of ongoing work that I'll discuss. And just to say, can people see my cursor?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, and I also wanted to say, you know, please, I've prepared this to be slightly, you know, slightly shorter. So if you have questions, I'm kind of counting on people asking questions. So, you know, that would be great. Okay, so just a summary of what I'm going to talk about today. So pulsars, which are just rapidly rotating neutron stars, are expected to host these what's labeled here as a radio emitting region. In which E dot B, the electric field, is parallel to the background magnetic field. And these regions, as I'll show, are very efficient sources of axions. And so I'll show that, you know, you produce a large number of axions here, and these axions can then propagate out into the magnetosphere and then convert into photons in the presence of this background magnetic field. And so for the remainder of the talk, I'll kind of deconstruct this cartoon piece by piece. Starting with this red line, which is the axion. So I don't think this I need to give too much of an introduction here, but I will do so. So to talk about axions, one must first mention the strong CP problem. The strong CP problem is just the statement that in QCD, you can add this theta term, which couples to the GG dual operator. And the main phenomenological consequence of this term is that it gives the neutron an electric dipole moment. And we can actually go and try to measure this, and we have been able to place experimental bounds on the neutron EDM. And this places an upper bound on this theta parameter of about 10 to the minus 10. And so this is you know, what's called a fine-tuning problem. We expect that in a natural theory, theta should be order one. So why is it so small? And so a very elegant solution to this fine-tuning problem was proposed by Peche and Quinn and Weinberg and Wilczek in the late 70s. And the idea is to introduce to the standard model an extra global U1 symmetry. It's called the Peche-Quinn symmetry. And this symmetry will be spontaneously broken. So we have some scalar field that's charged under U1, under this U1 Peche-Quinn. And so it obtains a BEV when the symmetry is spontaneously broken, and you can decompose it into some radial field plus a BEV, and then an angular field, which kind of winds around the bottom of this wine bottle potential. So as of right now, so we're going to identify this angular field as the axion. And as of right now, this particle is shift symmetric and massless. But there's an important effect in QCD, which is that non-perturbative effects play a role in specifically something like instantons. And the effect of instantons is to basically tilt this wine bottle potential. And this gives the axion a periodic potential, so such as 1 minus cosine of A over F, as I've shown here. And what this does is that it gives the instanton potential has a minimum at the CP conserving value. And so the axion will dynamically, this field will dynamically relax to the CP conserving state. And so this is the Peche-Quinn solution to the strong CP problem. And the particle that comes out of this, the axion, has a very well-defined parameter space, meaning there's only one free parameter, which is this axion decay constant. And once you have that axion decay constant, you can pretty much get all of the, you know, for example, the mass and other coupling constants up to some order one factors. So if you look at the Lagrangian for the axion, it has the normal scalar field contributions with this potential being the instanton potential or some other potential. You have the normal coupling to gluons, and I'm going to focus today on this particular coupling, the axion coupling to photons. And this, as I mentioned, this axion photon coupling for the QCD axion is well defined given this given the axion decay constant up to some order one factor here. And this factor just depends on how you couple this, you incorporate this Peche-Quinn symmetry into the standard model. But so what I've just mentioned to you is the QCD axion, but we expect similar particles to exist in string theory as well. And so the main ingredients you need are some gauge field, a p-form, and you need extra dimensions with some, you know, non-trivial topology. And the idea is that when you compactify on these extra dimensions, a large number of CP odd scalars arise in your theory. And we call these things axion-like particles. And here, when I use the term axions, I'm going to refer to either QCD axions or axion-like particles and make the distinction when necessary. But the basic idea is, for the remainder of this talk, I'll kind of treat these parameters like the mass decay constant and axion photon coupling as free parameters. So that this parameter space is somewhat less well defined than just the QCD axion parameter space. I'll also mention that axions make a very good dark matter candidate. And so the idea is that for sufficiently light axions, with masses less than about an EV, the occupation number per de Broglie wavelength is very large. And this means that the axion field can be described as a coherently oscillating classical field. And the evolution of such a field can be described by this familiar equation, which looks a lot like a damped harmonic oscillator. And if you look at the cosmological evolution of the axion field, you see that at early times, the field is frozen by Hubble friction. And then at a certain point, when the Hubble constant becomes equal to the axion mass, you start to get these damped oscillations. And one of the nice features of the axion is that in this damped phase, the energy density in the axion field decays like matter. And at present day, we see these very small wiggles at the bottom. And maybe I'll wait till it gets there. Yeah, so we'll see these very small wiggles. And so this is what the axion looks like at present day. So as I mentioned, I'll focus on the axion photon, on the axion coupling to photons. And this is the available parameter space, where on the x-axis you have the axion mass, and on the y-axis you have the axion photon coupling. And again, this is for a general axion-like particle. The QCD axion is shown in this band here. And it's a band, not a line, because as I mentioned, there is some amount of, you know, order one. There are some order one factors in the axion photon coupling that come from some model dependence. So the shaded regions here are existing constraints from astrophysical and laboratory searches for axions. And I want to focus on three in particular, and I'm going to review these ones because they provide good analogies and a good way for me to review some of the work that has already been done on looking for axions using neutron stars. And just for reference, the region I'm going to be talking about is this region right here, and possibly even lower. So we could potentially even hit this QCD axion line band at higher axion masses here. Okay, so I'll first talk about ADMX. And so the basic idea behind ADMX is that, well, if you look at this FF dual term, this is really E dot B. And so if I introduce a background, an external magnetic field, and my source of axions here is just some axion dark matter, then in the presence of this magnetic field, it can convert into a photon. Now, normally this effect would be too weak to see. However, the people at ADMX have found a way to enhance this effect by putting this entire setup in a resonating cavity. And if the resonant wavelength of this cavity is equal to the wavelength of the photons produced in this conversion, then you can get a boost in your expected signal by some large quality factor. And the analogy that I'll draw here is with a proposal made by a number of authors that I list here in the last few years. And I'm sure I'm leaving some people out, so if I am, I apologize. And the idea is that, you know, you have some axion dark matter falling into a neutron star. And in this turquoise region, and I'll describe what this turquoise region is, you get some kind of resonant conversion into photons in the presence of this very large magnetic field of the neutron star. And the photons that are produced kind of bounce back towards the Earth, and we try to detect them with radio telescopes on Earth. Now, I'll describe later in the talk what the nature of what this turquoise, or I guess cyan, I'm not sure what color this is. I'll describe the nature of the resonance in this region. It's not exactly the same as the resonance that occurs in the ADMX experiment, but it provides a good analogy because it's the same source of axions, which is dark matter, and you rely on some kind of resonant conversion. Okay, so the second experiment I'll talk about is CAST. And this, in CAST, you have a different source of axions. Instead of axion dark matter, you're actually producing axions thermally in the sun. And this is done through some kind of inverse Primakov process. And the axions that are produced are, they propagate towards the Earth. And then in this very long 10 meter cavity, they convert, again, in the presence of a strong background magnetic field, into X-ray photons that you seek to detect with a sensitive X-ray detector. And the neutron star analogy that I'll draw here is with a recent proposal by, you know, these authors. And again, I'm sure I'm leaving some people out. And the idea is it's very similar to the solar case, where in the neutron star, you produce axions that are bremsed off in this process here. And the axions convert rather not on Earth, but they convert again in the magnetosphere of the neutron star. They convert into X-ray photons that you can try to detect with space-based X-ray telescopes. And the last experiment I'll talk about is light shining through walls. And this has yet another different source of axions. And here the axions are electromagnetically sourced. And so if you look on the left here, you have some production cavity where you have a large external magnetic field. And in this cavity, you introduce a pump laser whose polarization is such that the electric field that's oscillating is in the direction that is parallel to the external magnetic field. And this means that you have a background E dot B, which sources axions. And these axions are able to penetrate these dense optical barriers, which photons cannot. And then on the other side of this barrier, you can convert them back into photons in a similar way to what I've discussed in the previous two slides. You just introduce another strong magnetic field and try to convert these axions into photons. And so this light shining through walls experiment is a good analogy for what I'm going to talk about with the neutron stars. And so just to solidify this analogy, this radio emitting region, it's a so-called gap. This region is like your production cavity in which axions are produced. And these axions are able to penetrate this dense plasma. So that's kind of like your optical barrier. And then they can convert here out kind of farther out in the magnetosphere. This is like your regeneration cavity. They can convert into photons that we try to detect. This is like our photodetector in the light shining through walls experiment. Okay, so before I continue, I'll maybe ask, this was all introduction, if people have any questions on what I've talked about so far. Okay, so then maybe I'll start by reviewing. So, oh yeah, sure.
So yeah, what will be the energy of axions you kind of will be considering produced in this gap?
Yeah, I'll talk about that a little later. So the energies are roughly in the, you know, megahertz to gigahertz range, mm-hmm. And this is set by the dynamics of the gap. There are some fundamental frequencies in the gap that will set what the energy of the axions is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The mass is a different thing. So, you know, the dynamics of the gap only set the energy. And so in principle, you could have very relativistic axions being produced in this region. But I'll talk about where these
kind of radio frequency.
Yeah, radio frequency, exactly. So it's in fact the same thing that's causing, I'm kind of spoiling the later discussion, but the same dynamics that give rise to radio emission are also what are giving rise to axions. Mm-hmm. And that's some kind of plasma oscillations in this gap.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Yeah, so I'll get into that, you know, in a few slides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, but before I talk about all of that, I'm going to kind of do a lightning review of pulsars and where these radio emitting regions, these gaps come from. So first of all, what is a pulsar? Pulsars, I mean, in the late 60s, the landmark experiment or observation of Jocelyn Bell and Anthony Hewish, they found a, you know, rapidly pulsating source, astronomical source. And it was later identified as a rotating neutron star that emits these beams of radiation that sweep across our line of sight in this kind of lighthouse looking effect. And neutron stars, I'll kind of motivate them by saying they're very good candidates for looking for new physics. For one, they have very large magnetic fields, which as I'll discuss, will be very useful for axion production and detection. And they have very stable periods that rival even some atomic clocks. And this makes them very good astrophysical clocks. And they've kind of been exploited to look for low frequency gravitational wave in pulsar timing arrays. And they're also, they have very strong gravity at the surface, which means one could presumably test deviations from GR in the presence of a neutron star. So I'm going to use some nomenclature when I talk about neutron stars. And I apologize, I use the term pulsar and neutron star kind of loosely, and I'll clarify that in these slides. So what's shown here, this is a diagram that's used to characterize the neutron star population. On the x-axis here, you have the period in seconds, and on the y-axis, you have the p dot, the rate of change of the period. And this p dot parameter is important for figuring out, it basically describes the spin down of the pulsar, and it can give us estimates of things like the age and the magnetic field, et cetera. At the bottom left-hand corner here, you have millisecond pulsars. These are, as their name suggests, they have periods on the order of milliseconds. And these are thought to be very old pulsars that have kind of died and then been spun back up through accretion of surrounding gas and binary companions. The bulk of this diagram are in these so-called active pulsars. These have periods between 1 and 10 seconds and magnetic fields between 10 to the 12 and 10 to the 14 Gauss. And these make up most of the pulsars that we have observed. And I use the term active to contrast them to dead pulsars. And this is an example of me maybe using the wrong terminology. I think people would say these are just dead neutron stars, not pulsars. But the idea is that these are sufficiently old that they are no longer actively producing pairs and giving off radio emission. And so they're very hard to detect. And so this kind of brings up an observational bias. So maybe this diagram is slightly misleading because it suggests that most neutron stars are in the form of these active pulsars. But in reality, this is purely observational bias. Most neutron stars are actually in the form of these dead neutron stars that lie in what's called the graveyard here. But they're just very hard to detect. So we don't see very many of them through their pulsed emission. And finally, you have these exotic candidates called magnetars. They have periods, you know, slightly larger periods than active pulsars. And their characteristic is that they have extremely large magnetic fields in excess of 10 to the 14 Gauss. There are a lot of questions around magnetars that I'll touch upon later. But if we understand them better, they can be very, very good tools for looking for axions and other forms of new physics.
Question. So, yes. So this estimate of magnetic field, actually, what is it based on?
Yeah. So this is an interesting question. I've been looking at this recently, and it's somewhat unsatisfying. I'll tell you the answer. So the way that they infer these magnetic fields is by assuming some model for the spin down. So they just treat the neutron star as a rotating dipole in a vacuum, which is certainly not a good approximation. But if you treat this as a rotating dipole, then you can get an estimate just from some Larmor frequency of what the energy loss rate is. Mm-hmm. And this can be translated into a, you know, an increase. It, as you lose energy, the period increases. And so from they infer the magnetic field just from measurements of P and P dot using this vacuum dipole approximation.
So loss of energy is into radio waves. Is it the main law channel of losing energy, or there's something else?
No, it actually turns out that radio waves make up a pretty small portion of the energy loss. So I think most, it of course depends on the pulsar, but for many pulsars, most energy is lost through gamma rays and X-rays.
I see.
And the rate, so the term that or the quantity that describes the amount of the spin down energy that goes into radio waves is called the radio efficiency. And this ranges somewhere from, 10 to the minus 2 to around 10 to the minus 8 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So it is a fairly small fraction of the total energy that's lost.
Mm-hmm. I see. So that's all model dependent. Well, in a sense, that's model based, estimate. So it's not direct inference from
my... Well, for the radio efficiency, they actually, presumably they do have... observations of things like the radio flux, X-ray flux, and gamma ray flux. Of course, you could say things like making inferences does kind of depend on a model. For example, if radio is highly beamed, which we expect it to be, and we don't see much radio, whereas X-ray is more isotropic because it's this thing is emitting thermally at X-ray, then you can say, well, maybe it depends on the exact beam model to make inferences about the total efficiency. But I think a lot of the statement that most of the energy is not in radio is fairly well supported by observations.
I was telling about talking about the magnetic fields, so that
So the magnetic field that is model dependent.
Mm-hmm.
And there is want to get too much into this, but there's a quantity that describes how good this vacuum dipole approximation is. And this is what's called the breaking index, which basically tells you how the frequency, the omega dot scales with omega as what power. And for a vacuum dipole, you would expect a certain power. And then you can also measure this breaking index from, just observation, and you do see a disagreement. Now, there are arguments that suggest that up to order one, you still expect the spin down to look like a dipole, a vacuum dipole, up to order one factors, even if you take into account other things. So I think, and another thing is people, there for a few of the pulsars, they have other observations of the magnetic field that come from things like the proton cyclotron. If you see some absorption lines at the cyclotron frequency of protons, you can get an inference of the magnetic field. And for the pulsars that we've seen, they agree reasonably well with the vacuum dipole approximation.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, thank you.
But I agree. It's kind of a weird that this vacuum dipole, this very simplistic model, is being used to infer the magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, thanks. Thanks for the questions. Okay, so I'll take a few minutes to review the electrodynamics of pulsars. And this is based on this landmark model of Goldreich and Julien. And the idea is the first step in modeling the pulsar magnetosphere is to just treat it as what I just described, a rotating conducting sphere in a vacuum, and this conducting sphere is bathed in a large dipolar magnetic field. And if you start to spin this sphere, then you will get a charge redistribution on the surface of the neutron star. And this means that you will source a potential outside in the vacuum, an electrostatic potential. And the main consequence of this potential is that it has an electric field component that's normal to the neutron star surface. I show that as this E parallel. The term parallel is with respect to the dipolar magnetic field. So it's parallel to the magnetic field. And this electric field can be so strong that it can dominate the gravitational force on electrons at the neutron star surface. And it can actually tear electrons from the surface. And eventually this will kind of continue until this vacuum magnetosphere assumption becomes invalid, it becomes inconsistent, because now you are no longer surrounded by a vacuum, you have a dense plasma there. And the idea is that this, you continue tearing charges from the surface until you are able to screen this parallel component of the electric field. And there you have what's called, you settle into what's called a force-free magnetosphere, in which E dot B is zero everywhere. And this is achieved when the charge density is given by this Goldreich-Julian density. Now, there's an important caveat that I want to mention here, which is that this Goldreich-Julian density is really, it should be thought of as a minimum condition for screening of this parallel electric field. But in principle, active pulsars can possess, you know, many more E plus E minus pairs than this Goldreich-Julian density. In fact, you know, what this Goldreich-Julian density is it's a net charge density. So this says nothing about this kind of symmetric component. If you have a large number of, you know, E plus E minus pairs that cancel each other out, basically. And so this is quantified, this uncertainty is quantified by this term kappa, which is the relationship between the true plasma density and the Goldreich-Julian plasma density. And this will turn out to be a very important uncertainty in a lot of the stuff I'll discuss. And luckily, there are some simulations underway that should shed light on this parameter. But I'll mention this again a bit later. Okay, so taking a kind of global view of the magnetosphere, there's an important length scale here, which is the so-called light cylinder radius. And that's shown as this, you know, this dotted line here. And the idea is that the plasma around the neutron star will try to co-rotate with the neutron star. However, co-rotation can only be sustained out to a certain distance, and that's this light cylinder radius. Beyond this radius, in order to co-rotate with the neutron star, particles would need to move faster than the speed of light, which is not possible. And so this light cylinder radius kind of classifies the field lines into two categories, closed and open. So these closed field lines are entirely contained within the light cylinder. And these open field lines shown in red will at some point exit. And the idea is that as charges move along these open field lines, they're eventually, you can say that they're ejected from the magnetosphere. And what this does is that it creates a gap right above this polar cap. So the polar cap is defined as the region on the neutron star surface that contains all open field lines. And so you start right above this polar cap, you start to develop a charge starved region. And this is called a gap. And this in this gap, you kind of reintroduce this electric field, this parallel component of the electric field. And this region is thought to be responsible for high energy emission. So this E parallel in here is able to accelerate electrons to extremely high gamma factors. And these can give off gamma rays. And this region, as I'll show, is also thought to be responsible for radio emission through a mechanism that I'll discuss a bit later on.
Ani, I have yes. A quick question for you.
Sure.
Completely dumb. So how do I understand that the E field is not screened?
Yeah, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the idea is that normally in steady state, it would be screened. But if you are losing charges, as one does when charges leave the magnetosphere, then you don't have enough charge to screen the electric field. So this state of E being of E not being screened, E parallel not being screened is also unstable. So I'll discuss this in the coming slide. Okay. Eventually, this will be unstable to paracascade, and eventually the gap will collapse again.
So it's time dependent.
It is time dependent, yes.
Ah, okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah, why don't you carry on? If you come back to it, then I'll wait. Yeah. For yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Let me know. Hopefully this will become clear in a few slides. And if it's not, yeah, please ask again. But yeah, I think it's important also to mention that this gap opens, but it is, it's important to mention that it is time dependent. Otherwise, you would not be able to source axions. And I'll show some detailed models of what this time dependence looks like. So as I just mentioned, once this gap opens up, it becomes unstable to pair cascade. And the basic physics is as follows. So if I look at this blue dot here, which is, let's say, an electron or positron, as it moves along this curved magnetic field line, it will emit curvature radiation. And these curvature radiation photons are extremely energetic. And they're so energetic that when they hit another magnetic field line, they can pair produce through this kind of Bright-Wheeler process. And the secondary leptons that you produce are also sufficiently high energy that they can emit more high energy photons, which then pair produce. And this process kind of continues until you into an exponential cascade of E plus E minus pair production. And eventually this will halt when the electrons and positrons are not energetic enough to further pair produce. But what ends up happening sooner is that you produce enough of them that the electric field gets screened again, and the gap will collapse. So just to show a cartoon of what this looks like, and I'll show some more detailed modeling later on, as charges flow out of the open field lines, as I discussed, this gap kind of opens up and you get this region in which E is parallel to B. And once it reaches a certain height, you're able to initiate pair cascade. And the height, the characteristic height of this gap is given by some mean free path of photons. And the idea is that, you know, if the mean free path of these energetic photons is larger than the size of some dimension length scale corresponding to the gap, then the photons will leave before they can, you know, initiate pair cascade. So this pair cascade can only start once the gap has reached a sufficient height. And once pair cascade occurs, then the gap will collapse into a series of localized sparks, and the gap closes. So
a question here. So there is this cascade essentially photon scatters on magnetic field and produce pairs, but there is another process where it just scatters on some infrared photon that all just present, you know, in the pulsar atmosphere. So which one is dominant?
So you're talking about, you know, like some inverse Compton scattering, right? Yeah. Where you upscatter some, you know, the electron will just upscatter some photon, right?
That can be, but also there are always infrared photons, just because plasma can be hot, you know, or the surface is hot.
Oh, I see. So, right. So there will, you're saying in this gap, there will also be some flux of high energy photons not coming from curvature radiation or anything like that.
Yeah, even not so much high energy. It's infrared usually.
So why would infrared photons be able to? Why are they important?
No. This curvature photon can scatter, can pair produce on the infrared photon. Not on.
I see. So you're talking about something like this Bright-Wheeler process, where instead of an external magnetic field line, you just have another photon, right?
Yeah.
So I think as I understand it, this is more important. I think near the neutron star surface, people say that this is more efficient. So if I'm very close to the neutron star surface, this magnetic field is very large, but they consider similar effects in the outer magnetosphere. And so specifically in this, what I show is the current sheet here, similar effects are happening. And because the magnetic fields are much weaker there, I think this Bright-Wheeler process that you're talking about, where you have two photons scattering, that becomes the dominant source of electron positron pair production.
I see. Yeah, that depends on the place in the...
Exactly.
I see. Thanks.
Yeah. And so there are some simulations that do this where they take into account a lot of these effects. And I think they find that, yes, this is near the neutron star surface, this Bright-Wheeler, or the external magnetic field is dominant. And then farther away, what you're saying becomes more important. Mm-hmm.
Annika, can I ask you something about this instability? So is this are these instability models somehow validated against data? So is there a very sharp prediction that then you compare with data, and then you make, you're absolutely sure that this thing happens?
Right. Yeah, no, this is a good question. The answer is there are, it's still somewhat difficult making connections with data. So they see some broad agreement. So with like the spectrum, for example, and also you can look at the shape of, when you look at the pulse, it has some features. For example, you'll see enhanced emission in the middle and then on the edges. So this is called the cone and the core. And this is able to, so these models are able to predict those features. And so it kind of depends then on how much agreement you want. I think if you ask someone in the pulsar community, they would say that these models are promising, but I don't think we're yet at the stage where we can say that these are, you know, definitively 100% the models that agree with data.
I see. And how often does this polar cap collapses? What's the time scale for collapse?
Yeah, so this is on the order of, I mean, it's happening very quickly. So this is maybe kind of not drawn to scale. This is actually a very thin sheath that collapses on, I mean, so this is on the order of, you know, megahertz to gigahertz. I mean, it is in here, you do have the, that is what the time scale is. It's basically this whole, maybe I'll show you. Yeah, so it looks something like this, where you have, so this is a toy model. I'll show a more detailed model in a bit. But basically this one period here corresponds to about, you know, a microsecond.
I see. And I guess that during the collapse, you don't have radio emission because the radio comes from the polar caps. And then this somehow modulates the radio emission, or you don't see that somehow?
Yeah, maybe let me wait to discuss this for a more, you know, when I talk about the more detailed model. Hopefully it'll make more sense then. I think it's a little hard to understand it with just this toy model that I've shown. Okay, so maybe, I'm getting a little low on time, so I'll kind of skip over the details of convert, or I'll go over the details of conversion very quickly. So the idea is that, you know, once you have this E dot B, you're able to, you know, produce a lot of axions. And I'll show some plots of that later on. I'll briefly talk about conversion and then revisit this issue of axion production in a more detailed model. As a brief warm-up exercise, you can consider a axion conversion in a uniform magnetic field, which is not the case for a pulsar. But just on purely dimensional grounds, you can see that the axion photon conversion probability scales like g squared, b squared, and then some length scale squared, just to make dimensions work out. And I'll use CAST as an example. There are two length scales in CAST. One is the actual length of the apparatus, and the other is this momentum mismatch between the axion and the photon. And this arises because you're trying to convert a massive particle, the axion, into a massless particle, the photon. And so necessarily when you convert, there will be some mismatch in the momenta. And basically this L for CAST is whatever the smaller of these length scales is. And you can kind of see that in the sensitivity of CAST. At low axion masses, the smaller length scale is the apparatus length. And then at higher masses, the smaller length scale is the inverse momentum mismatch, which is why you see the sensitivity come up here at higher axion masses. However, the people at CAST are smart, and they have come up with a way to do better than this. And the idea is that you can kind of mitigate the effects of this momentum mismatch by giving the photon a mass. And so they do this by introducing some pressurized gas into the cavity. And there they can kind of do better than this naive line, just by trying to decrease the axion photon momentum mismatch. And that's why you see this kind of spiky behavior here, because it's some experimentalist trying to match this, trying to match these, the photon mass to the axion mass. And this is exactly kind of what happens in a pulsar. You have some spatially varying plasma very close to the neutron star surface. The plasma density is very high. And as you move away, it decreases monotonically. And you expect that at some point, at some critical conversion radius, the axion mass will be approximately equal to the photon mass. And there you get a resonant enhancement in the axion photon conversion probability. And as I show here, this is kind of parametrically what it looks like, the conversion probability, where here B is the surface magnetic field, R is the neutron star radius, and ME is the electron mass, and omega the rotational frequency. Now, I've shown here in red this this kappa factor, which I alluded to earlier. This, as you can see, plays a very big role in the resonant conversion probability, because it would basically move around where this resonant conversion takes place. And there are some estimates that suggest that kappa can be as large as about 10 to the 5, which can have very serious implications for this conversion probability. So again, I'll emphasize the importance of simulations that are trying to estimate what this kappa is.
Yeah, so I also have a question here. So how should we understand physically? So why, if kappa is large, why the conversion probability gets smaller?
Yeah, so the reason is that basically if you introduce some kappa factor to this entire system, then it will basically push out where this resonant conversion is occurring farther away. And because the magnetic field varies as r to the minus 3, if it's converting farther away, then you expect it'll be converting in a weaker field. Now, this is just for the resonant case. One thing that's not clear from this is if you say, well, if it's so far out that resonance, even if it helps me by a few orders of magnitude, I would be better off converting non-resonantly closer to the closer to the neutron star surface. That is something that is possible. But yeah, I'll talk about this a bit later on. So I'll skip over or maybe move quickly because I'm running a little low on time, but I'll look at some sources that are particularly good to look at. So for example, the Magnificent Seven pulsars are characterized by very large magnetic fields, and they're very close to Earth, which is good for detection of radio waves. And they have also have very low radio noise coming from them. So we don't have much, there are very kind of stringent bounds on the radio emission. So this will allow us to place fairly strong constraints on axion photon coupling. I also alluded to these magnetars, and these would be very good candidates because they have very large magnetic fields. And curiously, many of them have not been shown to emit radio emission. And I think it's important. I'll emphasize the importance of understanding why we don't see pulsed radio emission from most, not all, but most magnetars. One can think of the most simple thing one can think of is that for magnetars, we expect the beams to be very thin. And so if they're just beamed away from us, it would just means that they're, you know, we've just been unlucky. We haven't seen very many of these, and most of them are just beamed away from us. But it's also possible that there are some more pernicious effects at play. So in particular, once you get to such high magnetic fields, you enter the regime, you exceed what's called the critical Schwinger field. And there you have kind of entered the regime of strong QED. And so a lot of the effects there are a lot of new effects that could play a role. So for example, this is one thing. So if you have this background magnetic field, then a high energy photon can come in and then split into two lower energy photons. And this, in very high magnetic fields, this effect can actually, you know, be preferential over, or so photons would preferentially split into lower energy photons before they pair produce. And this can have serious implications for the dynamics of gaps. And so this is something that is not well understood yet. And there are also more simulations that hopefully will address this issue. And I'll kind of briefly talk about other sources of noise. You have normal telescope noise and you know, standard astrophysical sources of noise, such as galactic synchrotron emission, which is especially important at these lower frequencies. And I'll show a kind of an estimate of the sensitivity based on these toy models that I've discussed. So on the blue line, this should be treated as very optimistic. And the reason is that this is for a magnetar. So this assumes that the dynamics of the magnetar are similar to that of the pulsar, which has not been verified. This just kind of is included to show the potential that magnetars have. And in fact, this is for, you know, this could actually go all the way down to the QCD axion line. And then a more realistic scenario is for one of these magnificent seven pulsars. And I guess I haven't mentioned what theta is. Theta here is the basically the viewing angle, where theta equals zero corresponds to us looking right into the beam. And theta equals 90 degrees corresponds to, you know, us looking along the equatorial plane of the pulsar. So I won't dwell too much on this because...
Yanni, I think yes. I've asked you this in the past. How does the average look like if you were to average over theta? Because how would this look like?
Yeah, so I gave you an... I think you asked me this a few weeks back and I gave you an answer that is no longer true. So, and I'll talk about this in a couple of slides. So what I've done... Okay. Yeah, so maybe I'll just wait.
I don't want to delay. Don't... reply later. So
sure. Yeah. I'll actually address this in a couple of slides.
Okay, great.
I mentioned that this stuff is should be treated as a toy model. And so some ongoing work we're trying to improve this model. So in this toy model of the spark gap that I wrote down, it doesn't account for many important effects, such as, you know, the true spectrum, spatial variations, and you have no way of predicting a priori what this paracascade time is relative to, say, like the rise time of the gap. And so now we're moving towards a simulation-based model, and this is based on actually doing first principle calculations of paracascade and of dynamical screening of this electric field. And so, I mean, I promised I would return to Daniel's question, and I will do so in the next slide when I talk about the simulations. And I also promised to return to Mina's question. So the conversion on which these lines were drawn are based on a 1D conversion model, which basically says axions and photons are moving along radial trajectories. And so you can treat it as a 1D problem. But this turns out to ignore a lot of important effects, such as, you know, refraction and reflection of photons, and this will actually greatly change what the, you know, differential cross section the differential emission of the axions as a function of solid angle. It will have very important implications for that, and it will also this 1D conversion model doesn't account for time dependence of the signal or spectral distortions, etc. So let me first address Daniel's question. So
Can I stop you just for 1 second? Actually, but it wasn't very, very clear to me how did the simplified model enter into the calculation to start with? Because I understand that you have, okay, in regions where ELB is non-zero, you get these axions and then you compare them. And then I guess you're setting bounds by looking at radio emission from the neutron stars, right?
Right.
Where did the simplified model actually enter in the calculation? Is it because you need to know the E dot B time dependence?
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So in this toy model that I wrote down back here, this is an average, slightly more complicated than this, the toy model that I actually used, but you use this toy model basically to calculate what the axion, how many axions are producing, what the spectrum of these axions looks like. And then comparing this to flux limits from various pulsars, you can write down some bounds.
I see, but why doesn't, I mean, I will naively have assumed that the only thing that matters is the average dot B, because your instability is so quick that in the end, what you care about is the average dot B. So why do you need this time-dependent thingies?
So the time dependence will also, I mean, it basically tells you what the spectrum, so when you look at something like this, it's periodic in time, And so you would expect you will have a lot of power in, you know, some lines basically at this fundamental frequency and then at higher harmonics. But, and this will, I mean, this kind of inaccurately describes what the spectrum looks like, which is important for doing the comparison to data. Also the maximum height. So in this toy model, this H here, the maximum height is based on some analytic argument for, okay, this is roughly what the length scale of the thing is, of the gap, of the gap. And so this actually, I mean, it's a decent model, but you can actually even underpredict. It turns out that you underpredict what the maximum gap height is, and hence the axion, the total axion production rate.
Okay. So may I follow up on the question? Like, how much does the like your sensitivity depend on like you assuming that the period is regular?
So the actual size of the signal doesn't depend too much on this. It will just, you still expect the same overall amplitude, but just with power concentrated in some particular frequencies. And so the issue here is that you will have a wrong estimate for what the expected bandwidth of the signal is, which is important for calculating, say, the flux density that you actually see.
So what is the like the width of like your signal that you're assuming for here?
Yeah, so here you would see a width of roughly, you know, fractional width of like 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 1. And it turns out that in the actual calculation, you do see pretty much a band, you know, a broadband signal of order 1, a fractional bandwidth.
And how does that reflect on your like sensitivity plot that you were showing us?
Yeah, so I think if I remember right, the scales like the bandwidth to the 1/2. It would get worse. The fact that that it's broadband, if I remember right. It doesn't. It's about an order of magnitude in the sensitivity, going from, you know, 10 to the minus 2 fractional bandwidth to order 1 fractional bandwidth. So as I was mentioning, you do have, so the, in my toy model, this whole thing is kind of uniformly growing and collapsing. But as you can see, so I'll draw your attention in particular to the fourth panel here, which is basically a plot of E dot B in this gap. So along the x-axis here, you have the radial coordinate scaled by this polar cap radius. And then on the z-axis, you have the, corresponds to the direction normal to the neutron star surface. And as you can see, you have very non-trivial space and time dependence of this. And what you can then do is what we have done is use the data from this simulation. And from that, you can actually compute the axion population or the production rate, treating this E dot B as a background, as a classical source. And so just for some parameters here, I'll show you for very light axion mass and axion photon coupling of around 10 to the minus 11 inverse GeV. This is what the spectrum looks like, and really this should be, this should be some differential quantity on the y-axis here, and on the x-axis you have frequency in megahertz. And what I'm plotting here is basically the density, or really it's like the flux of axions at certain magnetosphere locations. And what I'll show you is that, so I've normalized this by the local dark matter density, of course. If you wanted to compare this to something like axions falling into the neutron star, there may be a few orders of magnitude. For axions falling into the neutron star, the expected density is a few orders of magnitude higher than this local dark matter density, but it's at most, you know, 10 to the 3 or so.
So, Ani, just a heads up, we're hitting just below an hour now.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so maybe I'll try to wrap up soon. So this was one thing to improve the model, was to use these simulations to calculate the actual axion spectrum. But once you've produced them, the actual conversion should be done in 3D rather than 1D. And so what I'm doing with these collaborators that I list up here is to actually do this ray tracing analysis of propagating these axions. So the axions are shown in red here, and you propagate them outward, and they eventually convert into photons, which are these black lines. And these simulations will take into account all these effects that I mentioned a few slides ago, such as reflection, refraction, spectral distortions, etc. And so I'll revisit Mina's question about what is the theta dependence, let's say, of this signal. So it's actually, the answer is very different from what you would expect in just the 1D calculation. So what I'm showing here is a sky map. And the way to interpret this is, imagine that I'm standing on the neutron star surface. This would be this is kind of a density plot of what I see when I look out into the sky. And this is a log plot. And what I was seeing in the 1D calculation is that you would see most of the emission along the poles, which are shown here. But it actually turns out that this refraction effect that I mentioned becomes very important. And it means that axions, or rather photons, once they're produced, they refract towards regions of lower plasma density, which turn out to occur in these what are called the throat regions. And maybe I'll show you what this is. So in the magnetosphere, the throat is somewhere around here. So this is about 45-ish, degrees separated from the rotational axis. And so this is the pole, this is the equator, and the throat is somewhere around here. And so this is an important prediction of the 3D calculation that you don't see in the 1D computations. And as you can see, there are many, many orders of magnitude difference between the throats and the equator. And you can see that in this plot here. So this is a plot that was calculated based on these simulations. You see that the peak flux in the throat can be very, very large. And so this, I have assumed here that the axion mass, I guess I haven't written it here, is 10 to the minus 7 eV. And the axion photon coupling is 10 to the minus 10 inverse GeV. And then at the pole, you see that it's a couple of orders of magnitude lower than at the throat. And then at the equator, it's very, very much lower. And so this is important because it means that you have, the proposal is quite sensitive to where you are looking. However, I'll say that even in this equator, you see a flux of 10 to the 4 Jansky, whereas I mentioned earlier that flux limits on pulsars, on some of these magnificent seven pulsars, are as low as 10 to the minus 4 Jansky. So even if we're looking along the equator, you have you can get quite good sensitivity. And if you're lucky enough to be looking right at the throat, you can get phenomenal sensitivity. And we're still figuring out some details here, so I won't show any sensitivity plots for this yet. This is still kind of ongoing. Before I conclude, I'll maybe mention one possibly cute thing that we see, which is that a few of these states are emitted as bound states. So if you emit axions with
Might have been me, but I think we missed you for the last 10 seconds or so. Maybe it's just me.
Maybe I'll kind of repeat the last thing I said in this slide. Which was basically that even if we're looking at the equator, we can set reasonable limits. But if we're lucky enough to be looking at the throat, where the sensitivity or there the flux is much higher, we can possibly set very good limits. And I mentioned that as an aside in these simulations, one thing that we're seeing is that a small fraction of axions are emitted into bound states, meaning that they're emitted with velocity less than the escape velocity of the neutron star. And this is similar to some work that has been done by, for example, Ken, who has looked at, thermal emission of axions in the sun that are emitted into what's called a basin. And so in this case, the axion population can grow over the lifetime of the pulsar, and you can possibly get a very dense cloud. Another possibility is that, you know, because they're staying in the magnetosphere so long, they constantly convert, and you reach an equilibrium between production and conversion, in which the effective conversion probability is order one, and so it's independent of coupling. And these are things that we're just starting to explore and have some, you know, exciting possibilities. So because I'm low on time, I'll very, very quickly go through the conclusion. So I showed, you know, some models in which axions are produced in these pulsar magnetosphere gaps. And these have the potential to set very strong constraints on the axion photon coupling. And there are a few caveats or a few ongoing things that will really solidify this. One are these simulations and understanding all these effects. And right now I've talked about things in terms of constraining power, but depending on what these conversion simulations show us, we may have smoking gun signals to actually look for in the data, and potentially there's some discovery potential. Another thing is that these gaps, I talked about one particular gap, which is this polar cap vacuum gap, but these particle acceleration regions, these gaps are actually quite generic in astrophysical objects, such as, I mentioned pulsars, but also in black holes. So black holes, through this, so the so-called Blanford-Znaik mechanism, are also able to extract energy extract rotational energy from the black hole. And this is thought to be through a similar process in which you create a vacuum gap. And this is something that I haven't yet explored. And finally, in red here, I show there are some important problems for the pulsar simulation community to understand, for example, paramultiplicity in pulsars, and also the gap dynamics and pair production in magnetars. So if we can understand magnetars, I think some preliminary estimates show that we can get all the way down to the QCD axion line, and possibly even lower. So I think this is an important thing for us to understand. So with that, I mean, that's all I have. And thank you for your questions. And if you have any more, I'll happily answer them now.
All right. Thank you so much, Annie. Very interesting talk. Do people have questions in the audience?
We have a quick question. It's something that you probably said, but I missed. For your sensitivity, what we're assuming as an instrument looking at the Magnificent Seven, and what is the angular resolution that they have?
So you don't actually, I don't believe you need to resolve. I mean, I know they have resolved these things. But I mean, the parameters, that are you asking about the parameters being used? Huh? Sorry?
Just to have an idea. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this would be based on some, if I remember right, I think it's an hour-ish of observation of these things. What do you have specific questions about what the...
So with SKA or FAST?
Sorry. You meant which telescopes?
Which telescope, yeah. And I was wondering if you were relying on the angular resolution to look precisely, to target precisely the Magnificent Seven, or how you were subtracting the synchrotron background, basically.
Yeah, so I mean, I actually, when I calculate the sensitivity, these plots, if I remember, are for SKA, and I actually, it turns out that the flux limits that they have measured on the pulsar are much smaller than the synchrotron emission. So I actually have, in these sensitivity plots, I've actually assumed that the dominant source is coming from that synchrotron emission, not from the actual flux limits of the pulsar, which is, I would say, which is conservative, because these are larger than. So, I mean, if you wanted to do this, so this is why I said this is kind of a toy thing. If you want to do this in a more detailed way, you would have to somehow model out the synchrotron emission, you subtract that foreground and do something. But for me, I have just said, whatever the dominant source of noise is, even if it's synchrotron emission, which presumably we can subtract out, we can still get this sensitivity. So in principle, it should actually be better than this, I would say.
Okay.
Hi, Ani.
Hi.
I was asking a question earlier and I got cut out. Like,
oh, sorry.
Internet just died. So yeah, do you mind answering that question again? Sorry. Mm.
You asked about how does this the bandwidth affect the sensitivity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the actual flux density goes like one over the bandwidth. Okay. But you compare that, you also get some enhancement when you when you do the integration time, which goes like square root of the bandwidth. So mm-hmm. when you take these things together in the final sensitivity, I think it goes like the SNR, let's say, goes like one over square root of the bandwidth.
Okay.
And so for a narrow band signal, you would expect, so in the dark matter case where they do this, the fractional bandwidth is, the natural band line width is 10 to the minus 6. The actual bandwidth in these calculations is higher, but let's even just take 10 to the minus 6. You would get a boost of 10 to the minus 3 over just of order one fractional bandwidth. What I was seeing was that for this case, for the toy model, because these things are the spectrum is fairly concentrated at these lines, you get if I remember right, the fractional bandwidth of somewhere between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 1. In the simulations, you see that the bandwidth is order, fractional bandwidth is order 1. So you get hurt a little bit by by that. So that'll be about an order of magnitude in the sensitivity or in the SNR, which I guess is like a fourth of an order of magnitude in the actual sensitivity, because this
In the plot, like which one did you present, like in this figure, like is it the
this one is for the smaller fractional bandwidth. So you would expect if it's just the bandwidth, then this would be worse by about a fourth of an order of magnitude, but it also turns out that the simulations predict a higher so I mentioned here the amplitude of this E dot B is in this analytic model is smaller than what they predict in the simulations. And that effect turns out to help you much more than the bandwidth hurts you. What we expect, and I haven't shown any sensitivity plots based on the more detailed analysis, but you can kind of get an order of magnitude sense from this. Let's even ignore the optimistic stuff. Let's say we're looking very worst at this equator, the equatorial region. You see that the flux this is at 10 to the minus 10 inverse GeV, is about 10 to the 4 Jansky. And compare this to, let's say, around 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 Jansky of the flux limit. So that's about six orders of magnitude better. And so, you can still set very good bounds, even assuming the most conservative things. Yeah, so maybe I'll just summarize that. Yeah, here the overall SNR goes down by about an order of magnitude, which corresponds to a fourth of an order of magnitude in G.
So, like the other question I had was like, there are like a lot of very wiggly lines at higher energies. Where do they come from?
Yeah, this is, you see this kind of, it changes the shape here. This is because this is like the smallest, the fundamental frequency here. And lower than that, it's all just highly relativistic axions. You know, these are light axions that are at this energy. Once you get to higher energies, you start getting into this, the conversion starts becoming more complicated because now you're in this relativistic or semi-relativistic regime. And so the nature of the conversion changes. So here, actually, the conversion that occurs is non-resonant because the axion mass is so small that you would not really see. Yeah, but once you get out here, you can start getting resonant conversion, and those will show up as these spikes here.
So, like, if you change your model, like, these spikes will be at the different locations?
Yeah, you would. I think you would just move this around. I think you will still see a flat. You will still see flat sensitivity up to some fundamental frequency, and then yeah, you'll see wiggles. You still expect to see wiggles, but they may not be in the same places as here.
Then, like when you do a conservative limit, like basically, like it will be much worse at those energies.
Why? Why would it be worse?
Because like where these wiggles are, like depends on a lot on your models, right?
Right, but I mean, even if you forget the wiggles and just look at the overall envelope here, I mean, so two things. One is, in the more detailed model, I should mention that this whole thing, I was using the wrong screen to show my cursor, whoops. The whole thing will move down, just because the amplitude of E dot B that they see in simulations is a few orders of magnitude larger than what I'm assuming in this toy model. So that's the dominant thing that'll happen. Of course, there are these bandwidth things that I mentioned, and also you'll move this around, but you'll still have this general envelope here, and you will get spikes on top of the envelope, but still you see, you know, an envelope here. And in fact, it's actually more flat than what I'm showing here. The reason it moves up this envelope is that at higher frequencies, you have, you know, if you assume that it's dominated by this fundamental mode, then at higher frequencies, you'll get less support in the Fourier spectrum. But in something like this, where you have a much more flat spectrum, as I show here, and so you do expect that not to see this suppression as you go up. It'll be more flat, but it'll also have wiggles on top of it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, we have a question. Please just go ahead and unmute yourself, Nusrat.
Sorry. I have a different question. What is the magnitude of the cross-section for the photon from the axion?
The what, sorry?
What is the cross-section of the scattering photon from, or axion from the photon back home?
Oh, so I'm not really considering scattering here. I'm considering kind of a conversion. So, you're talking about axion to photon, right?
Yeah.
So maybe I can show some slides here. So the calculation will look something like this. If you look at the equation for axion photon conversion, so you can treat it like a quantum mechanical problem here. This is all in the 1D case. Of course, in the 3D case, it's more complicated. But here you have your photon mode and then your axion. And then you get a Schrodinger-like equation. So what I'm calculating here is just like if you start in an axion mode, how much do you? This is kind of like, you know, Flaber oscillation, like MSW oscillation. You will oscillate a little bit into into a photon mode, and this is what's being calculated here. It's not so much a scattering cross section. Like,
do you have any information from the magnitude of the cross section here?
Do I have any? I'm finding it hard to hear.
You have some number for this?
Oh, for like what the conversion probability is? I mean, it will be something like, so I think I asked this question. So for these, it's something like, again, for G of 10 to the minus 10 inverse GeV and M of 10 to the minus 7 EV, this conversion probability will be on the order of, you know, 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6. But of course, this will depend on parameters a lot, but it's somewhere in that range.
If you have any estimation from the velocity of the, for example, if a photon comes from a distant source, for example, from a gamma ray or magnetar, and is there, can we find some difference between the velocity of the photon and the velocity of the neutrino coming from there? And can we have some interaction between them? Because there are some scenarios that there is a difference, a delay between them reaching the photon and the neutrino from the same source, the same source.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some holes to play the delay between the reaching of the photon and neutrino to the Earth. And there are some discussion about the Lorentz invariance violation or describing this effect. Because of this, I am asking about the estimation of the cross-section of the photon from the axion. Because if you have the axion, for example, in a gamma ray burst, and if you have a good estimation for the cross-section, then we can say that the normal physics, the standard physics, we can resolve this anomaly.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I guess I haven't really thought about that. I mean, yeah, that would be interesting to think about.
Also,
I
haven't. Yeah. Can you say the archive number for your slides?
The archive number for my paper?
Yeah, for a slide, the same slides of your paper about the estimation of this number.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, maybe I'll enter it in the chat or something.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your interesting talk. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'll maybe put it in here. Are there any other questions while I'm doing this?
Currently?
What's the smoking gun?
That's right now we don't know. I think right now this pretty much just has constraining power, where you would say, just based on flux, you know, we have seen certain flux from this so that we can set constraints. But what we're looking for now is in these 3D simulations, we are trying to actually look for, you know, I think the best answer for the smoking gun signal would be some kind of time dependence of the signal. Because this this conversion surface, this resonant conversion surface, is going to be moving in time, and so we expect that conversion, the signal to track that movement, which is something that conversion surface is specific to the axion. It's when the axion mass equals the photon mass, and other plasma processes don't really care about that region. And so if we track that, maybe this can give us a smoking gun. But as of right now, it's just constraints from flux. Yeah. Sorry, I'll send my archive number. Any other questions?
So. You have some flux of axions coming out of these objects, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess you're looking into the conversion, but is there anything you can do with the actual axions that come out?
Yeah, this is a good question. So a few of the things that, so maybe the most basic thing one could think of is just looking for, since most of the axions are emitted, are not converted, only a small fraction of them are converted. Perhaps you can actually look for the axions on Earth with some experiment. But I think I did an estimate of this, and it turns out that this is, you would need to, it's better to convert them near the pulsar than on Earth, just because by the time they get here, if you want to convert it on Earth, the magnetic fields that you really want to, you know, exploit the strong magnetic fields of the pulsar as much as possible. Certainly, so I think this
do you bounce. Have some kind of diffuse axion background from this?
Yeah, good. So again, I think this will be small compared, because I mean the density will decay. If you look at the profile, it will decay like 1/r basically. And so unless you're very close to the neutron star, the density will be quite low. That's one thing, but I think an interesting thing is in this case of the bound states. you can possibly build up a cloud. And I say possibly because, I mean, the actual, it depends a lot on whether conversion is efficient, or if conversion is sufficiently inefficient, then, you know, you can, you may be able to build up a cloud of these bound axions. And if you have sufficient number of these, then you can look for other effects, such as, you know, perhaps the rotation of polarization of the pulsar beam if it's going through a very large axion cloud. So I had actually done an estimate where I showed, let's turn off conversion altogether. Let's say all axions that are emitted in, all axions in this, you know, that are emitted at low velocities are just kept in the magnetosphere. This is probably not the case because many of them will convert to photons, but let's just say that they stay. Then over the lifetime of the pulsar, the cloud density grows to be, I mean, it's sufficiently large that you would have kind of an order one axiom, you know, G times A. And so this can have order one effects on things like the pulsar beam. But of course, yeah, I will say that that is not a solid thing just because it ignores conversion, and probably conversion will suppress this or will quench this, the growth of this cloud. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I mean, if you have ideas that, you know, of what these axions could do once they're produced, that would, I'd be very interested to hear that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah.
Any other questions? If not, we can thank Annie again.